Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. During his first presidential term, Donald Trump was praised for not starting a single war, a notable departure from his predecessors. During the first 6 months of his second term, he and his team have actively tried to appropriate the peacemaking mantle, frustrating some allies and winning over some enemies. And then Israel bombed Iran. What does it mean for practical geopolitics going forward? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Fyodor Lukyanov, editor-in-chief of Russia in Global Affairs magazine and one of the most renowned Russian political commentators. Mr. Lukyanov, it's always a delight to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for this invitation.
Now, as we are recording this conversation, the United States, at least according to the American media, is mulling over a possibility of officially joining Israel's campaign against Iran. Do you think this decision, whether it's taken or not, carries any significance?
Yeah, I think it's a very significant decision in both cases, yes or no. And Donald Trump is facing a very important, I would say, conceptual, ideological choice. Because if he decides to join Israeli military action against Iran, and if so, then it should be a pretty significant involvement because Americans are needed there to really destroy nuclear facilities, and that's a big operation. That would be actually contrary to everything Donald Trump said from the very beginning when he appeared as a political person in 2015 and 16. And very fierce critics towards George W. Bush and other American presidents who were keen to fight wars abroad, that was his main point.
Absolutely, and I think you're saying that that may spark an internal crisis within his own administration. But what if he doesn't make that decision, that formal decision? Would that result in an international crisis?
No, I don't think it will result in an international crisis immediately. But of course, if Americans decide not to join, then the next question is whether Israel will be able to achieve maybe not destruction of a nuclear program, because really technically it's very difficult to do. But then I'm afraid the main focus will be moved towards regime change. And that's openly said already by Prime Minister Netanyahu and many other Israeli representatives that now it's time to finally get rid of this regime. And that means, that would mean to guarantee security of Israel. It's easier said than done, first of all. And secondly, I don't think it's, again, I don't think it's that much doable, but if they will succeed to destroy the current political system of Iran, the next question is what will replace it?
I do want to get to those questions, but before we get there, let me ask you a couple of questions about sort of the nature of the geopolitical moment, because it's known that Trump has spoken to Benjamin Netanyahu several times over the last couple of days, but it's still unclear whether Washington has taken any active role or given approval to this operation. And this reminds me of the recent Ukrainian drone attack about which Trump told Putin that he had no heads up about. And that raises a question of, America's allies getting so much independence that it is then up to the American leadership to decide what to do about it. What's special about it? I mean, I don't think it was the case before, and I don't think Russia's understanding of America's place in the world is actually, in accordance with these realities.
Many of Russians, even on the pretty high level, believe in American Almighty. Probably it's the last country in the world where people believe in the Almighty of the United States. And it's very difficult to understand and to grasp that in today's world, it might be very, very much unlinear, not as before. Of course, Israel, as an ally of the United States, has always been special. And there were episodes in history when Israel did act on their own behalf. But now it's not just about Israel, not just about the Middle East. I think the general trend in the international development is that binding alliances are getting out of use in the previous form, and more countries try to do what they want to do without relying on partners or believing that partners will have no choice but to support them. In the case of Israel, I think it's exactly this. They trust the Israeli lobby and the tradition of relationship that Americans, even if they are not satisfied, not happy, but they will be forced to support. That's the question. And that brings us back to the previous part, that Trump is facing a pretty significant dilemma.
Politico seems to agree with you because they ran a headline that in this attack the grandmaster has bitten the dealmaker. And I guess my question to you is, what do you think Benjamin Netanyahu's rationale here, opening a second front with a very powerful country, a country that is 10 times the size of Israel population-wise, without actually, you know, finalizing the Gaza offensive? What do you think Israel is after?
You know, the logic of the Israeli strategic community is pretty clear. After the enormous shock of October 2023, and after suffering a blow as never before, Israelis probably decided that now it's time to do everything without any limitations, to profoundly change the whole landscape in the region. And putting aside the moral side, they were actually very successful against Hezbollah. They are pretty successful against Gaza. Again, if we put aside the picture of we understand what. Iranian power was to a large extent based on cooperation with those so-called proxies. Objectively, that was obvious. Another blow to Iran was the collapse of Assad regime. And I think that Netanyahu and his team decided that now it's a unique moment when Iran is as weak as never before. At least after, I don't know, 1990s. And that's a gambling. That's they try to take a chance. I don't exclude that they will succeed. But again, the price is difficult to count. And of course, the situation which some people in Israel already aspire, that Israel will basically draw the new map of the Middle East, that's, from my point of view, is a totally utopian.
Well, I'm concerned not only about drawing a new map of the Middle East, but also the, as pathetic as it may be, the erosion of, you know, some basic forms in geopolitics, although admittedly there are not too many left. But still, Prime Minister Netanyahu over the last couple of days has been, you know, publicly toying with the possibility of assassinating Iran's supreme leader, as if it's something that, you know, you can do very casually. Do you think it's likely to solve the issue of Iran for Israel?
What does it mean, solve? That's the main question. What means solution in this situation? Again, a removal of the regime, which is, of course, utterly hostile to Israel, might solve some problems. But the question is whether the whole territory, this huge country
of more than 90 million people,
very different people, by the way, in an extremely vulnerable, strategically vulnerable region and place, what comes after Ayatollahs? And probably Israel expects, as Netanyahu wanted 20 plus years ago, expects democratization. Maybe you remember that the American invasion in Iraq produced a lot of euphoria for a short while, a lot of euphoria, including in Israel, that now we can democratize the whole Middle East and the old problems will disappear. We know the result. Now, probably, it is another take on the same. But to expect Iran to be democratized and stable after regime change, I have no imagination for this. And if it will be another version of Iraq, but tenfold or much bigger scale, I'm afraid that no one will be happy about that in the region at large.
Now, speaking about the erosion of international norms, I assume the Russian leadership also knows the whereabouts of the Ukrainian leader Vladimir Zelensky. But I think even at the heatest points of the Ukrainian conflict, they have never authorized a direct strike against a hostile leader. And I feel a bit stupid for asking about this, but still, I think people need to be reminded about that. Why wasn't it okay up until recently to, you know, openly try to assassinate a leader of a country that you don't like?
Yeah, that was product of historical development of
so it's an anachronism in today's realities, right?
Anachronism. We are now back to anachronism because, say, 300 years ago, it would be, or even earlier, it would be absolutely okay to kill the leader.
Okay, and even before the beginning of the World War II, it was okay to...
To assassinate. Okay, it's slightly different. The assassination is not an open action. But still, I think we are rather... the archaization of international politics. And, so far, it didn't happen. So we cannot say that now we are there already. But you're right that the very fact that this issue is being discussed and we don't hear any kind of strong rejection of this internationally, people are surprised and shocked by there is not a wave of support to Iran or the rejection of Israel. So that's a very bad sign, of course.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Russia not going after Zelensky more overtly is trying to project some sort of international norm?
Hopefully, yes, I think that Russia is committed to some informal norm. It's not a formal norm, it's informal. It's a rule of decent behavior.
It's essentially, or some unspoken gentleman's agreement among, intelligence agencies guys who are running some of those countries.
Another thing is, to be very cynical, each time you need to assess whether elimination of a particular person will help you or the opposite. So maybe in some cases it's better to keep those who are in place.
Okay, for the time being, let's consider that possibility while we are taking a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Fyodor Lukyanov, Editor-in-Chief of Russia in Global Affairs magazine. Mr. Lukyanov, before the break, you made a point that, before leaders authorize any dramatic operation, including assassination of their counterparts, they should consider consequences. And I want to continue with that line of questions, because Iran, as I mentioned, is a country of 92 million compared to 10 million, around 10 million in Israel. If this conflict lasts for long, do you think Israel can rely on its military superiority alone, or do you think there will be some sort of Iranian resistance?
I think that if this conflict lasts longer, will last long, that will be a big problem for Israel. In terms of resources, of course, but also in terms of conceptualization, what was it about? Because Iran has a lot of disadvantages, and we see that this attack demonstrated serious problems inside Iran and with the Iranian defense, the very fact that half of whole military leadership was killed by one moment, that was, of course, not...
How do you explain it? Because, I mean, it was clear that... I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu has been talking about the nuclear threat coming from Iran from, you know, early 2010s at least. So, you know, and he showed on many forums these pictures of how they are weeks away from developing a nuclear bomb, and yet... You know, the Iranians seem to miss such a huge blow.
It's a big question. I don't know, but it seems that Iranians miscalculated. They underestimated the commitment of Israel. They over-relied on their ability to have this very tricky, very sophisticated, long-lasting diplomacy, which is one of the big skills of Persian diplomacy since...
But it's an old-style diplomacy. I mean, in the beginning of this conversation, we talked about how the norms and how the landscape, the geopolitical landscape is changing when, you know, relatively small states can call the shots that their sponsors or allies have...
That's one thing, and another thing about old diplomacy, yes, but this old diplomacy doesn't work anymore because your counterpart operates according to a completely different worldview, so to say. So coming back to the question about prolonged war, I think that Iran, despite a lot of problems this attack demonstrated, has a capacity which... was, for example, very important during the previous big war Iran fought in the 80s against Iraq, when Saddam Hussein attacked Iran and believed that he could overthrow this regime very soon as well. And it ended up in an 8 years war of attrition, where Iran demonstrated, and at that time Iran was very weak after revolution and so on, but Iran demonstrated enormous resilience in terms of sacrifices, in terms of readiness to fight by any means. And okay, that was after revolution immediately. That was a different spirit than today. But if we take this experience into account, Israel, if they don't manage to overthrow Iran very soon, then they will face big problem and they will need ways how to withdraw from that.
You mentioned several possible sort of misconceptions on the Israeli side, and I think one other danger of a prolonged war is, you know, the deterioration of the already, you know, very hostile region. And in one of your recent articles, you made the point that Israel's war against Iran is the culmination of several decades of intervention in the Middle East, which essentially produced two forms of governance, either, you know, Islamization as the only sort of democratic or democratized version, or a militarized autocratic rule as a response to that Islamization. So it's essentially a choice between, you know, a bad and the worst. But I guess my question to you is, if you were trying to put yourself in the Israeli shoes, which option would work better for you in the medium or long term?
Traditionally, Israel was actually okay with all militarized, strongman-oriented regimes. Yes, wars with Egypt, with Syria, with... Arab countries in 60s and 70s with a mixed result. But actually, Israel was able to come to terms, including, by the way, Hafez al-Assad and then Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria. They had a certain kind, they were staunch enemies, but they had a very clear understanding with Israel, what to do, what not to do. And in this regard, Israel would be better off, from my point of view, with those strong authoritarian regimes, like in Egypt today or somewhere else. The question is that the trend is different, and we see that those regimes, which were products of 20th century, they weaken on the, or they disappear. Of old regimes of that style, we don't see any. Maybe Egypt, but also with some corrections. But be it in Syria, for example, we have something like an Islamized democracy. I don't think Israel is happy about that. Israel was much safer with Assad regime. And in case of Iran, that was a very special case because Iran overthrew the dictatorship or authoritarian regime in 70s, the Shah regime. And now it was a mixture, actually, of that was a militarized Islamist regime, but of different kind.
A hybrid,
but different kind than in Syria or other attempts. So in this regard, I just repeat what I said, that I think the biggest threat is that we will not get any rule in Iran in case of overthrow of this regime, and imagine that some politicians from exile would try to come, the son of the late Shah, or opposition in Europe, opposition in the United States, and then domestic opposition, and so Shia clerics. I'm afraid it will be a cocktail which no one could consume.
Now, you mentioned a couple of Arab states, and clearly, you know, Iran doesn't have a lot of friends in the region, but neither does Israel, to be honest. How do you think the neighbors of these two countries are likely to react, particularly the rich neighbors? I'm talking about the Gulf states.
They do not involve. We see it.
But I mean, it's likely to affect them anyway, because Saudi Arabia seems to be taking some custodianship of the Syrian events. But do you think they actually want a, you know, another endowment in the form of 90 people who are of different faith, of different sect?
No, I don't think they would be happy about this. Of course, relationship between Iran and neighbors, Arab neighbors, have never been warm. But just recently, it was more or less normalized relationship, and based on what we see now, the Gulf states they do not want to be dragged in; they fear it. They don't want to be too vocal. They condemn Israel, but like in the very moderate way. But they are afraid because the region is becoming more vulnerable at large.
Mm-hmm. And less manageable as well. Now, earlier this year, Russia and Iran signed a comprehensive strategic partnership agreement, which doesn't provide for military assistance. But I'm sure you would agree with me that Moscow cannot stay indifferent to what's going on in the region. And up until recently, the Kremlin played a very delicate balance between Israel and Iran. How is it likely to, you know, behave right now?
It seems, based on what we heard from President Putin recently, it seems that an attempt to delicately balance is still there. Russia tries to be positive, to be constructive, to offer something to both sides to settle this bloody conflict. The problem is that at this point, I don't see many. I don't see a lot of willingness on the side of those who fight, especially on the side of Israel, to seek a solution, a peaceful solution, diplomatic solution. Israeli goal is pretty clear, just to remove Iran in the current form.
Well, to remove the leadership of Iran. Technically speaking, it cannot remove Iran even if it nukes it.
No, I mean political leadership.
But
political
system. In this day and age, it's an important clarification, I think.
But Let's assume that Israel will not succeed with that, and the situation will turn into this protracted war, attrition war. Then I guess that the interest for some mediation or some ideas how to settle might increase. Another dimension is Iran-US. And here Trump is not very clear. On the one hand, he says unconditional surrender, demands total capitulation from Iran. On the other hand, he says that door for a deal is still open. What kind of deal can be done in these circumstances? I don't understand. But probably in case of U.S., they are rather about, really, about nuclear arms, not about regime change, while Israel is probably more about regime change. Anyway, at this point, Russian ideas will not be requested, but it might change.
And lastly, if I may ask you, I wonder if this tragic or potentially very dangerous development may also have some, you know, unexpected benefit for Russia, because the international attention span is fairly narrow these days, and the events in the Middle East are likely to divert attention from what's going on between Russia and Ukraine. Do you think Russia could use this situation to its advantage in any shape or form?
Cynically speaking, yes, that might be beneficial for a while and from one particular angle. And yes, I think Russia will use, what means use? Russia will do what it does. Russia continues, Russia has one priority now, just one priority, the Ukrainian conflict. And Russia will continue to push. And we see that on the battlefield, Russia is more successful, and that's very consecutive gains. Ukraine is pretty successful in other forms of the warfare, like sabotage acts and terror attacks. But for a while, when international attention is distracted, yes, I agree. But actually, it's very short-term gain, because after that, international attention, even if Iran war continues, international attention will seek something else. We know how it works. Just people want news to be renewed. And then I'm afraid that the general rise of escalation of global instability, which is very much fueled by Israeli attack, that might be pretty dangerous for all. And it will not divert in attention from Ukraine, rather to focus even more on all conflicts ongoing.
Well, Mr. Lukyanov, I hope for another chance to discuss it with you when the situation comes to the forefront. But for the time being, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.